Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we invite you to our new economy project here at The Brian Lehrer Show. It's a Facebook community for people looking for work and for anyone who can offer them help. We call it Help Wanted. Anyone can post your experiences or your advice or start a discussion thread of any kind related to the job hunt or read what our job-seeking bloggers are writing and how other listeners are responding. Go to WNYC.org. And click on Brian Lehrer Show to get to our Help Wanted Facebook community. So did you choose to watch the Oscars last night? Did our interview with Rick Lazio earlier in the show help you choose who to vote for? These choices might be minor, though Lazio might disagree with that statement, part of your routine. They may make up an important part of a daily gauntlet of choices, big and small. And in a new book called The Art of Choosing, author Sheena Iyengar, the S.T. Lee Professor of Business at Columbia University, examines choice in everything from the mundane to the life-altering. Let's step back and look at choice from a very wide perspective. Professor Iyengar, welcome to WNYC. Hello.
Hi, how you doing? Thank you for having me on today.
Thank you for coming on. And your book tries to get to almost an innate question about choice. Where does our desire to have choices come from? And your own background and family history, I guess, puts you in something of a unique place when it comes to choice. Tell us a little bit about your parents and why their relationship to choice was so fascinating to you.
I am a Sikh American. My parents came to the U.S. in the 1970s. And when they came here, they brought with them their Sikh culture. So I grew up sort of going back and forth between two different worlds. At home, I was Sikh, and that meant that you followed lots of rules. So, for example, you never cut your hair, and there were lots of different traditions and duties that you had to keep in mind. So, for example, marriages were typically arranged. So my parents met each other on their wedding day. In fact, they talked to each other for the first time on their wedding night, and most of the times your parents were involved in, you know, what career you undertook. So doctor and engineer was usually a good thing. But at the same time, I was going to American school. So every day I would be told, look, you're supposed to decide what you're going to eat, and you're supposed to decide what you're going to wear, and you're supposed to decide who you're going to be when you grow up. And my God, having someone else decide whom you're going to marry, how horrific can you possibly get? So I had this tension. I was going back and forth between one culture that talked about the importance of duty and obligation, and on the other hand, I had this other culture that was telling me the importance of personal preference, and there were two very different ideas about who makes the choices and the importance of personal choice.
And your book then cites a series of studies that show that the United States is on one end of the spectrum when it comes to individuality. I mean, I think everybody probably assumes this anyway, that our culture values individuality above almost everything else. Do you find that you can resolve this tension?
In what way? You mean in the person, in the culture, and in what way?
Yeah, well, take it any way you want. I mean, because you obviously grew up in this country, as you said, with the value of individual choice being inculcated in you at every step, but at the same time seeing your parents' successful arranged marriage, I don't know, do you think you have a different relationship to personal choices than other people and find a better way?
You know, it's funny. Most Indians that grow up in America, there's a phrase for us. They call us the ABCDs, American-born confused Desis, right? That Desi meaning the word for Indian. And that's because we are constantly going back and forth in certain domains. We act like Americans. In certain domains, we act like Indians. And I would say that, you know, you never quite get rid of the tension. And there are certain domains in which I decide to go the American way, and there are certain domains I decide to go the Indian way. But I think having that choice as to which one you want to go with gives you a broader perspective of what are the pros and cons of each.
More choice about choice.
And, yes.
listeners, how about calls from some of you about your relationship to choice? Do you have a story about how you make choices that may be different from your parents, for example? Do you have an immigrant story about choices, first-generation relationship to choice, second-generation relationship to choice? I once interviewed, many times I've interviewed immigrants who've said they love America, but the problem with America is too much freedom. And by that, they mean individual freedom. How do you make these choices like Sheena Iyengar, or maybe a question about how your upbringing was different from your parents? Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. Immigrants or second generation from immigrant families, particularly encouraged, but anyone welcome, 212-433-9692. For this Columbia University business professor, Sheena Iyengar, author now of The Art of Choosing. And your book draws on all sorts of studies that show how having choice can have even physiological effects on us. Are there health risks of not having choices?
Yes, absolutely. If you feel that you have absolutely no control over your life, you're much more likely to become depressed or become stressed out. So things like experiencing that local back pain that you can't seem to get rid of, those perpetual headaches. It could just be that you just are feeling a loss of control and don't seem to either recognize it or know how to articulate it for yourself. But that definitely causes a lot of harm to us. On the flip side, if you feel control, even when it's unrealistic to feel like you have control, it can actually make the difference between life and death. So, for example, people that have cancer, if they believe they have control over that cancer, even if it's ridiculous, like, you know, if I pay attention to how I walk, suddenly that'll help me control my disease. Well, it turns out just having that illusion of control can actually increase people's lifespan by an average of about 6 months. People with AIDS, if they believe that they have control over their disease, it actually turns out to help them live longer. So having control really is beneficial.
If the United States is at the far end of the individualist part of the spectrum, what are some of the most collectivist countries?
Definitely Asian countries are more considered to be more collectivist. Usually collectivist cultures are cultures that have strong religious backgrounds, strong emphasis on the community. Those are the two most important ingredients. And, you know, and just as you would expect, the more agricultural or agrarian the culture, and also poorer cultures tend to be more collectivist. So, for example, if you go, even in our own culture, if you go to Louisiana, and remember the Katrina disaster, and a lot of times people couldn't understand why these people didn't leave their homes. Why they didn't just, you know, go when they were told to go. Well, a lot of people didn't go when they were told to go, mainly because they were really coming from a more collectivist way of thinking. They didn't want to leave important members of their community that couldn't leave. They felt that they had that duty to stay back.
Rob in Asbury Park, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rob.
Hi. I was wondering if, choice is generational, and if, you know, my past generation was maybe happier because they had less choice. But I see a lot of people in my generation, X generation, with lots of choices, but they often seem miserable because they can never decide as far as occupation and things of that sort.
Professor Iyengar?
If you think about what's happened in the last 50 years, we have literally experienced an explosion of choice, and we're not actually mentally prepared for it. So in 1949, the average grocery store had about 3,700 different products in it. Today, the average grocery store has 45,000 different products in it, and our brains haven't caught up with that change. The average Walmart has 100,000 different options in it. And that's not even getting into what's available to us on the Internet, that explosion that's happened in the last 10 years. And our brains are really struggling to get our heads around trying to figure out even how to memorize these choices, how to understand how they're different from each other, what are they? So that's part of the reason why we're really often in a state of confusion or feeling overwhelmed.
Andrew in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, how are you, Brian? I was actually, like, homeschooled by my family in Europe. And, like, I've done everything possible to sound like and look like an American. Like, it's okay to have, like, everyday Oktoberfest for my brother and my sister. Like, that's fine for them. But I'm, like, super happy with the trillions of choices I have every day waking up in the Bronx. Because, like, I would not trade living in Garmisch ever again of, like, 7 months of snow. And, like, yeah, it gets racy here in the Bronx. But, yeah, I'm glad to, like, not sound like them. And that's a choice that I actively made.
Like, yeah.
Well, that's great. I mean, that you understand what you really value. And you've made a choice that's consistent with that. I mean, when we feel confident about what we choose, it can be the most amazing experience.
And thank you, Andrew. In your book, you call for an end to tolerance about choice. What does that mean?
Interesting question. So, you know, we often think that what it means to be culturally sensitive is, you know, to eat Chinese food or use some chopsticks on occasion and understand, well, those people act this way and I act this way. And part of the problem is that if I assume that those people will act that way and I'll act my way and we go our separate ways and don't bother each other, it doesn't solve any big problems. And that's part of what led to the situation we are in right now. I mean, we ultimately have to engage with the world in terms of what their opinions about choice and freedom and democracy and on politics like global warming and all kinds of commons dilemmas that we have to deal with. And in the old days, when we disagreed with somebody, we would say, well, might is right. We'll just beat them up, and whoever happens to win, well, their view dominates. But in this day and age, we can't do that, and we can't go our separate ways. So we essentially have to have a dialogue. And we have to figure out what our views are, what their views are, which means we actually do have to listen. We have to figure out where we actually differ and where we actually have some common ground. That's the only hope we have for creating some collaboration.
Sheena Iyengar, professor of business at Columbia University, my guest on WNYC, author of The Art of Choosing, another immigrant story from Felix in Brooklyn. Felix, thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you for giving me the opportunity to say something. The freedom here is good as it is. I'm first immigrant, you know, to this country. You know, in my home country, you know, Nigeria, it's in complete mess because people don't have freedom here. And other people wanting to come to America are coming here to live out their life they want. What the professor is saying, to some extent, is okay. But, again, trying to restrict that individual freedom, we create havoc here in America, and people won't have any other place to go. So it's going to be chaotic. Maybe she has to modify her views.
You'll live with the chaos for the freedom that it gives you.
Hello?
Felix, you'll live with the chaos for the freedom that it gives you, is what you're saying, yes?
No, the freedom, you know, we don't have, you know, chaotic situation here in America because of the freedom.
The freedom mitigates against chaos, you're saying. Felix, thank you. And I think by contrast, Carmen in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Yes, interesting. You know, freedom is difficult for some people, carries responsibilities. There were instances before the Soviet Union fell that people who were able to escape and who came to America could not handle the freedom. They, oh, my God, what am I going to do with my life? What am I going to do with a job? And too many choices. And there were some cases where they actually went back because it was too stressful. They couldn't make the choices.
Thank you. And you use Russia, pre- and post-communist era, as an example in your book, Professor, yes?
I do, yes. I was really struck by how many ex-communists even now long for the old days. I mean, I was there when the Berlin Wall fell, and it was this great moment of freedom. I mean, we celebrated freedom that day. And now you hear even East Berliners talk about how they want the old ways back, that was freedom, that we don't know what freedom is in capitalist societies. I mean, we think freedom is that we all have to So I guess let me give you an example. East Berliners would say, you know, in the old days, the only place I could go for a vacation was Hungary, but at least I knew I had a vacation. Today I can go anywhere I want, but I can't afford to go anywhere. Mm. In the old days, I only had one doctor, but I had a doctor that I knew I could count on. Today, there's a bazillion doctors, but what doctor do I go to? Who can I trust? And the ones that are really worth something, how much will I have to pay? And I can't really afford that.
And that's the tension in a nutshell.
That is the tension.
So our next conversation with our next guest is going to be about Oscar night. You referenced the movie The Matrix in your book. What's your Matrix metaphor?
I think that we are often afraid that we are victims of the Matrix, that we're really worried that we're constantly being manipulated the way the people were in the Matrix, and we are. But I think the way in which we can get around the Matrix metaphor, is if we just keep track of what our priorities are. That's really the best way to deal with the world of too much choice. If we know our priorities, then we can zero in on just choosing what really matters to us.
Sheena Iyengar, that's Iyengar, by the way, if you want to look for her book, which is called The Art of Choosing. Thank you so much for coming on with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up in a minute. What you missed at the Oscars, if you have cable vision, and more from the ceremonies, including my favorite acceptance speeches. Stay with us.